This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.
After 4 years serving as vice mayor, added to at least two in previous times, I said to myself and I said to John, you know, I would appreciate your considering me for the challenge of chair of the Budget and Finance Committee. With some of our budget projections, it will be truly a time of great challenge.
Changes at City Hall as Mayor John Cranley picks David Mann to lead City Council's Budget and Finance Committee. Christopher Smitherman is Cincinnati's new vice mayor.
Both men have very big agendas over the next 4 years, and we've been talking about that. And I'm very confident that the agenda that both of them are putting forward, that it is something that I can support.
Joining us for our weekly review of local news from the Cincinnati Inquirer, political columnist Jason Williams, City Hall reporter Cameron Knight, and investigative reporter James Pilcher. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And good afternoon, James, Cameron, Jason. Thanks, everybody, for being on the show today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
James, let's start with the story that you wrote this week that two Cincinnati police officers may have violated taser policy in an incident that sparked the recent rift between City Manager Harry Black and FOP President Dan Hills. So who are the officers and what about this incident that they're being investigated for? What was that about?
Well, the two officers are Larry Johnson and Richard Sullivan, and they were called to a domestic dispute back in early August. A mother wanted her two sons to leave her apartment. And so they show up, and things just immediately escalated from there, and they wound up using their taser on the two young men quite often, at least six or seven times between the two of them. That turned into an arrest. It turned into a scuffle. The two men were arrested. One was actually charged with felony assault on a police officer. So fast forward a little bit. One of the brothers, they were half-brothers, one of them filed a complaint with the city's Citizens Complaint Authority, which is the outside watchdog agency that was set up after the collaboratives, and they filed a complaint there. So that agency has subpoena powers and the ability to interview anybody, including the officers, about an incident under city law. Well, as the city's own, the police department's own internal investigation was going on, and these people, the CCA was also trying to interview these officers. All of a sudden, the FOP president, Dan Hills, asked for them to stop until the case was fully prosecuted. It was in court, obviously. These two men had been charged with some serious offenses. So, you know, that was kind of a precedent. I mean, they usually don't do that. They usually don't. I mean, the city and the CPD don't stop their own investigations just to let the case continue. They agreed to a short delay, and then when the delay was over, CCA tried to get the interviews with the officers again. That led FOP President Hills to go to the prosecutor, Joe Dieters, who tried to intervene, couldn't get him to back off, and that eventually led to a temporary restraining order against the city from doing an investigation. That led to Harry Black, the city manager, making that angry phone call to Dan Hills near midnight around Halloween, shortly before Halloween, that became public. And so all of this came to light in late October, early November. Well, when we found out about that this was over this particular case, we went back and said, okay, we want to see the body cam footage from this case. What was so special about this case that they would go to that amount of trouble to try to halt or slow down the internal investigation? And after the two men wound up pleading guilty to a couple of offenses, one of them still has yet to be sentenced, we got the tapes. Now, we're actually fighting that further. We feel we should have gotten the tapes immediately, that they're not an investigatory record, that they're not privileged information. We should have gotten them as soon as we asked for them. So we're actually taking that case to the Supreme Court. That's just an aside. But in the meantime, I finally got the tapes. I presented them to two outside experts.
What did they conclude?
Well, they concluded that there were some potential serious violations here. One of them was more harsh than the other one. Well, judgment. They used the taser as which should be one of the weapons or tools of last resort immediately and that they the cops helped escalate the situation. The other expert said, yes, they probably violated the taser policy, which in the CPD's own manual said only when you're trying to subdue someone who is actively resisting arrest. It's underlined and in bold in the CPD's own policy. And yet, if you look at the tapes, they pull out their tasers and start using them almost, you know, they start threatening tasers within 5 minutes of coming in the thing. That being said, one of the brothers does stand up and make a threatening move towards his mother, who's screaming in the background about all this. So it was kind of chaotic. And it was an enclosed space. And obviously, the officers were trying to resume control of the situation. But both of them agreed that the officers didn't separate the family members, which is usually the case in a domestic dispute, and that they actually helped escalate the situation. It's still under investigation internally by CPD, and CCA is still yet to finish its own investigation. But like I said, if those experts, and I've seen some comments online about this story, if those experts, you know, that I was just putting out there a narrative that I wanted to, that wasn't the case. If these experts come back and said, hey, they followed policy, they were under danger, this was the case, I would have printed that.
Who were the experts, by the way?
Well, one is actually a well-known study, a 20-year officer who works for an agency called the Police Foundation. He's also a PhD associate professor of criminology down in Florida. And he's also an associate or a senior fellow at Police Foundation, which is a well-known, well-respected nonprofit institute, looks at police practices, and actually police departments work with them. So it isn't like they're looking for issues with police. The police actually use these people. And the other is an expert witness out of Cleveland and an expert in use of force who was a longtime police captain and commander. Long time on several different forces, including in Colorado and outside of Chicago. So it wasn't like I, you know, went out looking for people who were anti-police. These are ex-policemen who know what they're talking about.
So do we have any idea, James, how long the official investigation is going to take, or typically how long do these?
Since CCA was only able to get their interviews going with the police officers later last month because of the temporary restraining order, which has since expired, I wouldn't imagine the CCA or its board or its, to issue any recommendations until at least later next month or February. They've caught up on a lot. They've hired another investigator, but they were still quite far behind. As for the internal investigation with CPD, that could take another month or two. They usually, you know, and something as complicated as this one, too, I would imagine that it could take a couple months to get any kind of resolution on this. Now, the CCA can then, if they find that, yeah, things weren't done the way they're supposed to, they can recommend to the city manager, here's what we think should be done, but it's then up to the city manager and the police chief to implement that if they feel it's necessary. Whereas CPD, obviously, internally, can discipline officers if they find wrongdoing, you know, as long as it follows the union contract. This is by way of background. One of these officers, Lawrence John, Larry Johnson, was involved in the now, quote unquote, infamous Bones case, the shooting of a young man in Northside several years ago. He was the officer who showed up and then took over the scene, and he was in front of the subject when another officer shot the subject, David Hebert, known as Bones. And Johnson's also been disciplined for mouthing off to the city manager in an open meeting before. So he's not. This isn't his first time in the spotlight.
Now, Jason, there have been some changes at City Hall. David Mann, who was vice mayor, is now going to become the chair of the City Council's Budget and Finance Committee, and Councilmember Christopher Smitherman is now vice mayor. So put this in perspective for us. What does all this mean? First off, we heard in the opening cut David Mann talking about challenges that he's going to face as head of the finance committee. So what's he getting himself in for in this particular role?
Well, we're potentially, you know, looking at a recession. There's some certainly the city's budget is not looking all that great. You've got to they have to figure out how to balance out John Cranley's big union raises that he gave last year. You've got They just now dipped into the reserve fund for a new soccer stadium. So there are a lot of challenges coming up, and that's, you know, they want to dip into, they want to take out debt for the Western Hills Viaduct. So there's a lot of maneuvering and challenges to try to figure out how to balance all this out and make sure the city's bond rating doesn't dip or and there are certainly plenty of other examples as well of things that David Mann's really walking into a pretty tough position, but it's arguably the most powerful position at City Hall beyond besides the mayor. So
why wouldn't he have just stayed in the vice mayor's position? Why?
Well, John Cranley wanted to he wanted to make Christopher Smitherman. Well, there was discussions between about Christopher Smitherman potentially being budget chair. David Mann potentially being budget chair. He really wanted both of them to have high-ranking, high-profile positions at City Hall. With a majority Democratic council, it's probably best to have David Mann as the budget committee chair in terms of trying to get votes for things. And Smitherman, who is an independent, a fiscal conservative, or is known as that, would probably be better suited for vice mayor in this situation. Now, politically, kind of, underneath it all is this ongoing battle. We're already starting to talk about the mayor's race in 2021. P.G. Sittenfeld, certainly considering running. Christopher Smitherman, certainly considering running. John Cranley is a Democrat. Christopher Smitherman has been incredibly loyal to John Cranley. He votes for his agenda. He's helped him rally votes for him among African-American voters. Christopher Smitherman has done a lot for John Cranley. And so this is John Cranley's way of really helping to, hey, you help me, I want to help you. And so this was Cranley's way of really kind of endorsing in the 2021 race without endorsing. And so basically he's saying, look,
technically he can't, right? Because Smitherman's an independent.
Correct. Okay. And well, he could, but it's probably wouldn't be, that's going to come back to bite Cranley and his political future. And so that's what's happening here. He's not probably going to officially endorse in that race, but this is his way of endorsing, saying like, look, I'm behind Christopher Smitherman by making him the vice mayor, and I hope that he becomes my successor in 4 years.
We will continue our review of the news, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining me this afternoon as we discuss local news of the week from the Cincinnati Inquirer, political columnist Jason Williams, City Hall reporter Cameron Knight, and investigative reporter James Pilcher. You can join us at 513-419-7100. Email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Talking about the changes at City Hall, Cameron, meantime, you have Councilmember Amy Murray, who is going to be Jim Renacci's running mate in the governor's race on the GOP side. So tell us a little bit more about this.
Yeah, that was announced this week. Amy Murray has been on council. She has been the been a conservative on council. She on a lot of issues kind of has she abstains a lot on some issues and hasn't had a huge outspoken position on council. But she announced this week that she would be running alongside Renacci for lieutenant governor. Renacci is from kind of the Akron area of Ohio. So Murray represents Southwest Ohio, another major city, a name in another major city. So she has recognition in another part of Ohio that Renacci may not have been a part of. During their press event to announce their running, they both claimed to be to have entered politics from the business world.
And hang on just a second, Cameron. We apologize. We're having some trouble with your mic here. Okay. So let's have you switch over to this other side here, this other mic, and see if we can't get better results. But it's interesting. So if she does not have to leave council at this point to run for lieutenant governor, correct? She can just stay on council till she knows one way or the other whether she's been elected or not.
Correct, and that's what Murray told me after their press conference. She said she planned to stay on council until the election, and then if she wins, obviously she would step down and take the position in the governor's office. If they don't win the election, then she will remain on council and serve out the rest of her term.
Yeah, and they've got some tough competition in this. I mean, they're going up against Mike DeWine and John Husted.
Those are a
dream ticket for the GOP.
Right. A lot of it's about name recognition. So you have you have DeWine and Husted, who have huge name recognition in Ohio throughout the whole state, and while the you have the Northwest represented. Again, Murray is going to be kind of trying to have that name recognition in Southwest Ohio, where Renacci probably does not have that right name recognition down here. Since he's more of a Northwest Ohio kind of guy.
What's the agenda for this particular ticket? Is this a pro-business, pro-growth kind of ticket?
Yeah, well, Renacci is a pro-Trump, pro-business guy. During their press conference, they both made a point to say that they were business people who entered politics out of frustration. Renacci claimed as part of the automotive bailout situation that occurred under the Obama administration, that started actually under the Bush administration and continued there, he claimed that a GM dealership that he owned, was shut down as part of that. So out of frustration, he dove into politics to try to make a difference. And while Amy Murray pointed to frustration with the city balancing its budget, she worked for 14 years at P&G and then went off and started her own business. And she said that in those positions, she watched the city struggle to maintain a balanced budget, and that's what forced her into politics. So they both have this sort of outsider pro-business stance that they are both pushing forward.
Meantime, Mayor John Cranley's announced his plan for the city to come up with its portion to help pay for replacing the Western Hills Viaduct. I think the city has to come up with, $33 million?
Correct. So the city, this week, John Cranley announced that he had a plan to basically take out $33 million in debt, to have the city take on the debt for the project. That is matched one-to-one by the county, and the county has its own plan to have $33 million. That brings the total up to $66 million. It's supposed to be 20% of the total cost of the whole project. That's sort of the magic number, this 20%. The city officials have said if they have that 20%, then it's much more likely that they can get the state and the federal government to pay for the rest of it, basically.
Yeah, and the rest of it, I think, at this point is, about $200 million they'd still have to come up with?
They still have to come up with about a little over $200 million. The total cost of the project has been estimated at about $335 million.
So what has to happen? Oh, go ahead, James.
I was just going to interject and say that, I went back after this was announced. I went back, and I remembered I had done a story, and I actually think I was on the air with you, Mark, when we talked about this. Back in early 2014, we did an analysis of the city's balance sheet and found that it was upwards of $1.2 billion in debt. And I can tell you that I don't have the numbers specifically since then, but it's only gotten worse. I mean, they're talking about borrowing for the FC Cincinnati Stadium if they win the bid. I know they've moved some things around to try to fill some holes that were created, as Jason talked about, by the new holes or the new shortfalls created by the raises for the union. And right now, as of three or four years ago, they were paying $120 million just on their debt payment alone out of general fund money. So, if they're going to continue to add debt, this is talking about another $33 million on top of what they already have. I know that there's concern at City Hall among some administrators that they're already reaching their debt cap. And where are they going to be able to borrow from? Their bond ratings are already kind of on a teetering. They stabilized it after the pension was fixed, sort of. But, there's also concern that if they keep borrowing, they're going to lose some of the rating, and then therefore their interest rates are going to go up. It's going to be even more expensive for them to borrow.
Yeah, James has nailed it. Like this, what? And if I could add, this Western Hills Viaduct press conference that the city had the other day was really a dog and pony show. I thought there's really no plan from the city right now to really pay for this. You can easily say, yeah, we're going to take out debt. But, you know, that's you got to cut through a lot of that. And James has done that. And we're doing that. And you look at it and it's just not there. The money's not there right now. Don't see where the money's going to come from. Pretty risky to take on more debt, $33 million. However, the county, on the other hand, has actually come up with a plan. And you got to give them credit for the $5 increase on the license fee to help pay for the Western Hills Viaduct. I thought that was a really good move by the Board of Commissioners led by Todd Portune. That's a plan right there where you found new money. You had they passed it with, you know, there was really no resistance to it. You know, it's $5 extra onto your – I thought it was a good move by them. And it's new money to help pay for something that desperately needs to get done, a project. This bridge has been – we've been pushing on this thing pretty hard the last couple years. And it's – I've gone underneath the thing and it's a – it doesn't take an engineer to look at it and think, man, this thing is in bad shape.
Yeah, it's 75 years old. And
And just follow up on that, you had talked, Jason had talked, and I think Cameron had talked about the changes to City Hall and the shuffling of who's going to handle the budget and stuff. Tax revenues are going to go down. By all indications, tax revenues are potentially going to go down over the next 2 years. It's kind of like, okay, we're making less money. If you're a business, it'd be like, okay, we're making less money, but we're going to borrow more, and we don't know how we're going to pay it off. I mean, that's kind of the short thing about this particular idea on top of the debt they're already carrying.
Cameron, so what has to happen next in order for Cranley's plan to take effect?
So next week they're going to vote on a motion, which basically is just a promise to pay $33 million somehow. And there's also attached to that an ordinance that allows – well, not attached to, but aside of that, there's an ordinance that permits the city manager to take out the $33 million in debt, to issue that debt, which is the standard kind of procedure for these kind of things. When the city says we're going to go into debt, they just authorize the city manager to allow that to issue that debt. And it's going to be issued over the next 6 years. And Cranley has said that Cranley has had another plan called CAP, which was a comprehensive road repaving program that was launched, has kind of been ongoing right now. And that was sort of paid for with this sort of structured debt system as well. And as from Cranley's point of view, as that that debt falls off, those payments fall off on this road paving project, that money will be able to be focused onto the Western Hills Viaduct.
You know, James was mentioning a concern over adding additional debt by some in city administration. What kind of support does Cranley's plan have on council?
Well, so far, when he came to the press conference yesterday, he had 6 signatures on his motion already. The people who have not signed on, so there's 9 people on council. He's got 6 signed on already. Chris Seelbach, Yvette Simpson, and Wendell Young are the 3 council members who had not signed on yet. I reached out to all of them to see if they supported it or didn't, and I wasn't able to get a hold of any of them yesterday. But it sounds like you only need 5 votes, and it sounds like he's got 6.
Now, Jason, the Southwest Ohio Regional Transit Authority has decided to keep its connection with the Cincinnati Bell Connector, the streetcar. Who was leading the push to break the ties with the streetcar at SORTA?
So there are a couple or 3 board members who are conservative appointees of the county, held over from when the county was a majority Republican. Ron Mosby, Greenberg. I'm drawing a blank on the other person's name right now. But these are folks really who Chris Monzel, very fiscally conservative Tea Party types, who do not like the streetcar, flat out don't like the streetcar, and are concerned about the perception of the streetcar hurting a potential transit tax effort in 2018 or 2019, whenever they try to get this going. And so as long as the streetcar is connected to SORTA, it's going to be what they believe is it's going to be hard to get any new money to help improve a bus system that really desperately needs it. Buses are breaking down. Routes are going unserved. You know, the UC Economic Center did a study, I think it was now a couple years ago, about 75,000 jobs are unreachable by transit in the region. And it is a problem, and it's nationally, Cincinnati continually ranks very low in terms of connecting people to jobs on public transportation. And when you talk about really wanting to attack poverty and getting people to work, public transportation is certainly a big part of that issue.
So we had three members of the SORTA board who were in favor of this. We had what? It was eight, I believe, that voted against this.
Yeah, 8-3 was the vote.
What was the reason for rejecting the...
The fact that there's no – I think there was a belief that this is a little rushed. You're going to make a chaotic situation more chaotic. There needs to be more thought put in. There's certainly going to be a lot of your bureaucracy involved in terms of, you know, transferring who's doing what and transferring contracts and potentially breaking contracts. And so there's a lot of those types of things that still need to be worked out, a lot of the wonky in the weeds types of things. And – that was not addressed prior to this resolution being brought forth. And so that was part of the big concern, was that like, hey, we can't just snap our fingers, vote for this, and then it's all going to just magically happen. You know, I give them credit for thinking, hey, when it comes to the streetcar, you got to be very thoughtful, unless, you know, otherwise you're going to make what's already been a mess and, for the most part, a failure, even more messy.
So what are some of the other challenges that you see for SORTA in terms of this transit tax?
In general, just the fact that this has not been a region that's embraced transit. As I wrote in a column the other day, that transit generally, you know, this is a predominantly conservative region. And even though the county's trending blue, I still probably from a fiscal standpoint believe that this Hamilton County is relatively still conservative. And so you have a county that doesn't like new tax levies. You have a county that, you know, we've seen with stadiums. We've seen, you know, we've heard that there's a belief that the suburbanites do not like the streetcar. Now, that's an anecdotal thing, you know, based on comments and emails and Facebook and Twitter and, you know, just conversations. But, you know, the big thing is, so you start to stack all that on top of each other. Transit's never been a big deal around here in terms of, you know, Metro Moves have failed miserably and back in 2002. It's always been looked at negatively, and we're not just alone in that. And I hate to say this, but this is, you know, from my reporting over the years, having previously covered transportation. Sadly, there's a perception that, you know, buses are for poor people. And, you know, I think there's some racial elements that play into that as well. And so there's a huge challenge here for the transit authority to break through that. And then you throw the streetcar on top of that. And people, you know, generally it's a hot button issue that, and so it's going to take a lot of work.
Sounds like they have their work cut out.
Absolutely. Yeah. To position themselves just to give this transit tax a fighting chance is going to be a challenge.
Cameron,
if I could jump in.
Sure, go right ahead.
If I could jump in for a second, the other issue that is, and Jason nailed them all on the head. But the other issue that's unique to Cincinnati and Hamilton County is that this area, transit's hard, just geographically. And the way that the city and the planning has gone throughout the decades and centuries is that it's hard to get around in Cincinnati locally. The interstate system is pretty good, but locally, the streets, especially on the west side, there's no easy ingress or exits. It just makes transit more difficult and more expensive. Yeah. As well. So that's an added situation. That was a big issue with the Metro Moves that Jason, that's why it was so expensive, is you start running new rail lines or bus lines direct up through there. It's just, it's a maze of streets up there, and it's very, very difficult.
The hills in this town, I mean, we're not Columbus, where we're flat and laid out really as a basic grid. Transit experts have said this, the hills in this town and the narrow streets and the river being there make this a very complex region to, add and build out a new transit system.
James, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And Jason and Cameron, thank you too.
Thank you.
Thanks.
From the Cincinnati Inquirer, political columnist Jason Williams, City Hall reporter Cameron Knight, and investigative reporter James Pilcher. Coming up, a Kentucky state representative commits suicide after he's accused of sexual assault. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining me now as we look at news from Kentucky, Tom Loftus, who covers the Kentucky State House for the Courier-Journal. Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
And Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Ryland Barton. Ryland, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Mark.
You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll start with the story about Kentucky State Representative Dan Johnson. He committed suicide Wednesday night after facing sexual assault allegations. Tom, who was Dan Johnson? Tell us about him.
Dan Johnson was an upset winner in an election just a year ago for state representative. He was a rookie state rep, like so many in our Kentucky House, rookie Republicans, I guess with the help of Donald Trump, swept up a lot of seats, gained a majority in the Kentucky House. He was very low profile. He was a controversial figure in the election last year, partly because of the racist posts he had put on his Facebook page prior to that election, when the Republican Party of Kentucky actually disowned him in that near the end of that election. But he won anyway. I never got to know him very well. He was here for a year in the General Assembly. Always seemed to be a cheerful guy. He's a minister. I believe Ryland probably knows him a bit better than I do, has covered this story a little bit closer. But he was pastor of the Heart of Fire Church in Bullitt County, which is suburban Louisville, basically. The Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting in Louisville, which is with the WFPL, basically Ryland's outfit, did an investigative piece on him that began running about a week ago on, I guess it was Tuesday or Wednesday morning. He denied the allegations, said he was not going to step down from office within this report. And Wednesday night, it was shocking that he had committed suicide.
Ryland, yeah, going to the specifics, Ryland, what were the accusations against Dan Johnson?
And so it's a fascinating story, and one with, I mean, as we know now, a very, very sad end. Mm-hmm. Representative Dan Johnson, this story had, it uncovered this basically years of kind of misleading and deceptive claims that he had made, and also probably the most incriminating and what led to calls for his resignation earlier this week was that accusations of sexual assault of a 17-year-old girl. It was a woman who's now 21 years old. She says that it wasn't a representative then, but that Dan Johnson had sexually assaulted her in the basement of his church after a New Year's party in 2013. There's a lot more to this story. There's a lot of claims that reporters at the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting were checking into, and there are these fantastic claims that he had raised people from the dead, that he had witnessed the planes crashing into the Twin Towers on 9/11, that he had set up the morgue at Ground Zero, and then also some alleged criminal activity, that he had hired people to burn up his Cadillac in the 80s so he could collect insurance money on it, and also that, you know, possible allegations that he was involved in burning down the previous version of his church in the outskirts of Louisville, and also for, you know, because finances weren't right, and to for insurance purposes. So there's this whole life of kind of a deceptive activity were included in this report, which was just published on Monday. Very quickly afterwards, the state parties, both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, as well as his own caucus, the House Republicans, all called for him to resign. He, as Tom said, Tuesday morning had a press conference with his family and friends at the Heart of Fire Church. He seemed to be in good spirits. He up and down denied the allegations. He didn't really get into the specifics of any of them, but made notes, especially deny the sexual assault allegations. And then, and people say, you know, they had talked to him within the 24 hours afterwards, and that he was supposedly in good spirits. And then this total surprise out of nowhere, he put an apparent suicide note on Facebook, once again denying the allegations. And partially, it sounded like he was blaming it on post-traumatic stress disorder from, you know, his imminent suicide on post-traumatic stress disorder. And then, you know, with
well, Ryland, I never quite. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Tom.
His post-traumatic stress disorder that he said he suffered from was stemming from his right. his rescue or his attempt to help people immediately after 9/11. Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. That.
I mean, it wasn't like he was a soldier in Afghanistan or that. It was he said he was injured, right. Suffered respiratory damage and other things from witnessing.
Tom, didn't he have surgery for the respiratory problems?
I believe he did. I don't know that for sure.
But he did. He has been collecting his attention from it.
His widow did talk about having a lot of medical care for respiratory problems in interviews she gave in the last couple of days.
She's actually planning to run for his seat, isn't she?
Yes, that's correct.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. What else has she had to say about his death?
Well, she's blamed his death on the media. She's blamed it on reporters covering this issue, and especially the ones who broke this story, my colleagues at the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting. You know, neither she nor Representative Johnson had gotten into really the specifics of denying any of the allegations. You know, both the reporters at the at the center and me as well have been asking him, trying to get a hold of him over the last year to kind of address some of these allegations, and he refused to respond to any of them until this press conference just a few days ago.
I think it's worth pointing out that very early this week, immediately after the report came out, that Mac Brown, the chairman of the Kentucky Republican Party, came out and called for Dan Johnson's resignation, and he pointed out that the story was so well documented and raised so many important questions that he had no choice but to call for the resignation. And if it was convincing enough for Chairman Brown to go that far.
And Tom, you have to wonder, I wonder what your thoughts are on this, and you too, Ryland. You have House Republican leaders and you have the Kentucky GOP chair calling for Johnson to resign. But you haven't heard them call for the resignation of former House Speaker Jeff Hoover or any of the other House members who've been accused of sexual harassment.
Well, Governor Bevin has certainly called for the resignation of those four who signed a confidential settlement that the Courier-Journal revealed, I think it was on November 1, with a woman on the House Republican staff who alleged sexual harassment. The state party chairman, as well as the other Republican, the remaining Republican leaders, say those are two totally different circumstances. And keep in mind, Jeff Hoover, the former House Speaker, who resigned over this allegation, you know, has insisted there was no physical sexual activity, that he was just involved in exchanging some inappropriate text messages with this staffer, which he said was a big mistake and was wrong, and he resigned the speakership for it. But he said it was nothing that wasn't consensual. And this is all still under investigation. It's been handed over to the legislature's Ethics Commission. And I think the Republican leaders who have not, for the most part, who have not called for Hoover's resignation or other representatives' resignation involved in this, want to see the results of that investigation.
Ryland, any thoughts?
I think the other point to make is that Representative Johnson is a freshman. He was a freshman lawmaker. He had already been kind of relegated to the back bench of House Republicans after his campaign, in which he had made racist posted racist pictures and comments on Facebook, especially dealing with the president, portraying him as a monkey. And I think that, you know, he'd been relegated to the back bench because of that. I mean, House Republicans said that they welcomed him into his caucus, but still, I think that he wasn't, anyway, I'm just saying that I think he was a little bit more politically exposed, in these situations than, some of the House leaders that have been implicated in the sexual harassment scandal.
Ryan, let's talk about that. Governor Bevin had been calling for a special session before the end of the year to vote on his proposal for fixing the state's ailing pension plan. Is that special session going to happen, or what's the status of that?
I mean, I guess it could happen. You know, the governor could call a special session, and we'd all have to show up on Monday. But it is very, very, very unlikely. I think that at this point, the governor's kind of holding on to this, saying that he still could call a special session just so he can kind of continue to apply pressure to lawmakers to keep on working on this deal. I think that, you know, much more likely is that this was something that will be dealt with in the regular session. There's talk that we're going to have we'll get a copy of a revised plan, a revised pension bill sometime soon. So that folks can review it before the legislative session. We'll see if that happens, and we'll see what's in it. I think it's very unlikely that pension stuff will be dealt with in a special session before the end of the year.
Tom, what's your feel for that? You think that the Ryland has a point there?
The chances of a special session are about equal to those of the Bengals making the Super Bowl. It's, I guess, hypothetically within the realm of possibility, but... And the governor's not said, and only he can call the special session. But they're basically out of time, and the session would have to last at least 6 days. And here we are on December 15th. I think House leaders are, like the governor, committed to getting, I know they are, they're committed to getting a pension bill passed and passed quickly. But at this point, the argument is very strong that, hey, why don't we save the money that would be spent on a special, convene as we're scheduled to January the 2nd, and get it done quickly in the regular session? A question in my mind right now is, how quickly can they get a pension bill passed, even if they put it off till January 2 to take it up? Because whatever is going to be in this final version, pension bills are are almost always going to be very controversial, particularly now with the spotlight on.
Yeah, what was in Governor Bevin's plan? What were some of the details, the highlights of that, Tom?
Well, the two most controversial provisions. The governor's trying to bring this under control. We've got a more than $40 billion pension debt. And a couple of the things he proposed were, number one, a new 3% deduction from all teachers and public employees, that's state and local, whether you're a Covington employee or a state government employee here in Franklin, a 3% deduction from their paychecks to help pay for retiree health benefits. That was very controversial. Also, teachers now get a cost of living adjustment in their pensions after they retire. The governor's plan, again, another move that would save the state money, that would help to bring the dollar problem under control. These COLAs would be suspended for 5 years. And those were very, very unpopular. There are a lot of other unpopular provisions to it, and some others. It's being renegotiated. I don't know if Ryland knows any better than I don't know where the bill stands now. But a revised bill, I expect to come out before the end of the year and to be considered January 2nd.
And Governor Bevin eventually wanted to move to a 401k style system, right?
Well, yeah, I forgot kind of that. That's kind of the main thrust of the.
I mean, so and it's mostly for future state workers. So just about all future state workers would be moved into 401k style pension plans. But then current state workers, once they reach 27 years, including teachers, they would be shifted into 401ks going forward. So they keep, you know, their conventional pension benefits would be capped, and then going forward they'd be put into 401ks. And that's just, I mean, that's something that on down the line it's going to say it would, you know, probably save the state money. But in the meantime, what it kind of does is it deprives the pension systems, which will still be there and still be paying benefits out to, you know, retired teachers and, you know, people retiring in the future. But it kind of deprives it of any fresh blood coming into the system and putting more money into it.
Tom, they have to move pretty quickly, though. I mean, the situation with Kentucky's pension systems is pretty bleak, isn't it?
It's fairly bleak, to say the least. And I expect they will move in January with passing a bill. But, you know, a really large part of this is simply within the budget. Part of the governor's solution is to go to a new method. It's too complicated to explain here in a minute. The new method of funding, which immediately raises the amount of money that the state and local governments put into the system, so that we can immediately start taking up, and the amount the state would contribute would go down under the Bevin approach through the years. But it starts making bigger payments in the early years to get a bite out of this, to really bring it under control and hopefully avoid the risk of having liabilities spin out of control in the future.
Tom and Dan, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. Or Ryland, excuse me. Tom and Ryland. My apologies, Ryland. Tom Loftus, who covers the Kentucky State House for the Courier-Journal, and Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief, Ryland Barton.